Can you hear now? Yes. Well, you seem to have only 50 or 40 or 35 minutes, so we'll have to go faster than usual. Usually I like to have about 2 hours so that we can see the slides and then have a discussion. And the discussion is at least as important as the slides. So I think I'll try to do the slides in 15 minutes. Maybe I can't. Well, many of you have seen the slides anyhow, or have seen some of the buildings that the slides are showing. And instead of trying to present you with a concept, which might look pretty abstract, though I think it's pretty real, at the beginning, I'll try to convey some of those concepts at the end in the discussion. So what you see now at the beginning is some of the buildings in Scottsdale, and then some models, and then some of the work we do in Cordes Junction with the new building that we call Arcosanti, a town for 3,000 people. This is the plan of Cosanti, and the first experiment, the second experiment, third, fourth, and so on. Most of those are silt casting or soil castings, which means you pile the soil, you shape it, and then you do your shell in concrete, and then after that you excavate, and you do the interiors. And this happens to be the entrance here. Could I get a glass of water from somewhere? Thank you. The first experiment was done as a consequence of doing silt casting, slip casting of ceramics. And due to the nature of the soil, I decided I would try something larger. So this was a casting. Instead of clay, it was concrete, a 30 by 30 about a slab. And it became a little house. The same thing was for this one, for this studio and ceramics area a little later on, and then for this one and so on. Now I'm going backwards. This is these apse made on a silt. It's a silt casting. We do ceramics there. This is a tunnel going into this area. The cat cast looking from this side, from the south side. The little drafting room. The north studio looking south into the ceramics area. We do the ceramics in that place. This is one of the patios, and that's the swimming pool canopy. The same patio. This is the little house, being about 6 feet below grade. It's not an underground house, it's a below grade house, which makes a big difference. The larger studio and drafting room. Thank you. Some of the techniques, this was the procedure we used in building this apse. And this is silt. We are now casting this section. That's paper. While you build, you have to keep up the structure until you get your keystone in place so that the structure becomes structurally completed. That's the making of this keystone. You see, that's the silt. And that's after the completion, after the keystone is cast, you can free the structure. The area where we do the ceramics, an old skylight in cardboard, the new skylight in plastic and concrete. the making of a wall, the same technique by using soil in this case. The silt comes from the riverbed here in the salt riverbed. But this is soil, and, which is on the spot where we live. It's about 5 feet deep before you get into the caliche bed. This is the structure and the wall. So you see the negative here, you see the positive there. The making of another form for a storage place. And you see the ribs being cut, and now we are pumping the concrete to make this shell. And there you see the difference between the areas where you have the plastic and the area where you don't have the plastic. The soil is incorporated somehow in the shell. By using colors in this way, you get chromatic elements in the structure. You'll see them later and better. This is one of the phases in making this shell before the structural casting. Before and after. We have a number of ditches cut by the bulldozer while we were excavating those structures. So what we did, we landscaped in this manner by just packing the soil and reshaping it every 3 or 4 months. And then we decided we would make them permanent. So we cast thin shells about 1.5 inches thick in concrete using just the chicken wire as a reinforcing of some sort. And that's it. The making of an apse, including one of the patios, this time using 10 poles as a form. Those are conical arches. You go up one at a time. 1, 2, 3, and then we are finishing this apse by assembling an arch which has been precast on a silt bed. This is the silt bed and the arch after this has been demolished. So you have a shell again divided in segments, missing the keystone, which is going to be cast in place, and this is the assemblage of those elements. You have to keep in mind this is all amateur work, no professionals involved, and done practically without cash, no money at all. This is the keystone built on the spot. A bench, honing, a table, and a treehouse on this structure. This is the making of the walls of the larger house we call the cat cast, because the caterpillar tractor shaped the roof before the casting. This is gunniting. We use gunniting in 2 or 3 occasions. This is casting by hand. And this is the texture of the ceiling in this earth casting technique. This is the glazing line. I prefer not to have the lights. Those are railroad ties supporting the roof. Those are little dividers that we cast in on the ground and lifted using colors. Painting, in other words, the form with cement colors and then casting. The beginning of the canopy, 12 telephone poles on 4 footings. The shaping of the form in soil, the painting, and then the demolishing of the form and before the raising and the raising. This is the color finished. We're coating the color and we're going to put the reinforcing and then the structural shell. This is a 30-ton slab, 32 by 32. And this is the color that you get in this procedure. This is the excavation for the swimming pool. The swimming pool is located so that in winter it's sunny, in summer has some shade on it. One of the few occasions when professionals were called in to do a good finishing.
and then we painted fresco-like using cement colors. Unfortunately, this was done 6 years ago, so, or five, and last spring we had a bad algae case, and we put too much chlorine in, and most of the paint faded off. So now we are covered up, down to there, and then white, or almost white. The making of sticks of concrete reinforced by wirelan, which is thousands of little wires about an inch long and 10 mils in diameter, thrown into the mixer. You make a slab and you have dividers on the plywood form, so you end up having those sticks. After they are cured, you assemble them, for instance, in this way. This is a guide. And you go up with the structure that you had designed, pre-designed. This is another structure we are building at the same time. And this is the apse for the foundry work. Now, I'm using this spherical shape very often, and I'm going to use it in Arcosanti again. The reason is that it shelters an area which is an outdoor area, but sheltered in such a way as to be very sunny in the winter and very shady in the summer, if this is open to the south. We'll talk about that later when I show you the model of Arcosanti. This was the other, the very rough mound, and somehow domesticated mound. This is a model room. We made all the models for the arcologies inside of this room. This is the making of another apse, the smaller, the quickest one. You have a very rough mound, you finish the top of the mound and you cast. So you keep casting down horizontal layers and finishing first in this manner the soil form. So we are going to cut down another level and do the footing casting last. And then you excavate, and the students are putting their own designs in. There you see the design that this boy is putting. This is the last building at Cosanti, and I used the flannel cloth about 3 feet wide, dipped in plaster, made in that shape by hanging it while it's wet on a metal frame that you don't see there. Then when it's stiff and pretty rigid, you assemble them on this scaffolding and you make a bolt, the form for a bolt, and then you cast your structural shell. And what you end up is that inside you have this flannel as a permanent form, you see there. The first flannel segment, sewer pipe that became a little studio. We have four of those, they work quite well as you have two tables. This is the glazing, using power poles and whatever we could put together. Now, we started this work with young people during the summers, and that went on for about 10 years, I think. We used to have one summer workshop, then we got into three or four, now we have nine this year. Last year we had 11, we had 250 students in our group, the more permanent group, and they've been working on a new site. But this photo was taken when we were still pretty small, and it's one of the meeting to discuss the work and the reasons for doing what we do. The Cosanti Foundation, which is the foundation that I somehow founded, is supported by work of this kind, metal work, ceramics work, and royalties, and some commissions, and traveling, and so on. So that's how we carry on the work, the development of ideas and so on. This is a foundry casting. This is sand for a big bell, like that one. Those are large groups. like mobiles. This is a styrofoam original cast into aluminum in this case. The original was in styrofoam also, and then was translated into this 20 feet figure in Corten for the center down in Phoenix. This was also aluminum from styrofoam. The application of the technique of casting on the soil was used in Santa Fe Theater because we were asked to do it so. This is an outdoor theater. It's about, the staging is about 20 feet below ground grade. This is the stage with staging at different levels, roof, bridge and so on, and also staging along this runway that you see there. Let's go back. This is part of the runway. The preparation for the forms of those two columns that have staircases inside. The beginning of the work for this inverted shell. Those are the forming for those shells. A view from the top coming down. There's a bridge here. Those are the light towers. This is one corner of the stage showing different textures, wood, soil, and embankment. It came out very bad. This is the runway. This was began as a workshop like the ones we have in Scottsdale, and it ended up like something like a prison camp, and so I got out of it with my group. And this is the back of the stage. This is the roughness of the form that we use as a casting backing. Some of the models of bridges, and I'm showing those because they contain somehow the beginning of the idea of making use of large structures for different purposes instead of for one purpose. So the bridge contains all the facilities like restaurant or viewpoints or collections, museums and so on. Those were made in silt originally and then cast in plaster in this case. It's a tubular structure, not a tubular structure. The same one. A bridge which also works as a ramp because you can come down into the lower level or go up. The underside of that bridge. A double cantilever bridge. Same one. A sketch for a one cantilever structure. It could be half a bridge or a full bridge. This is the sketch. This is the three-dimensional sketch. For the Corcoran exhibit that took place about 2 years ago, we made a large model of a suspension bridge. It's a 45 feet model, I think. It's a suspension bridge, but instead of having two pylons with their own foundations and then the anchorages with very massive foundations. Again, you have only two pylons with foundations and nothing else. And this happens because this pylon balances with its own weight the other pylon, and the cables between them are supporting the roadway, in this case a three-level multi-lane highway. So you have an inch there against the pylons, and then this pretty heavy arm sticking out, balancing the opposite arm. Inside there will be other facilities like a collection or something connected with the history of the place or so. The first activities about an urban problem was this Mesa project, and I picked up a mesa as a wasteland area, site, And on this wasteland, I tried to organize a town for about 2 million population. The idea was that you used land which is not good for farming, for instance, and at the same time you use water at least twice. You dam at the site where the dams are more desirable, and then you use water domestically and power production and so on, and then you recycle and you go down and use the water for farming. Now this was done about 12 years ago. And 12, 10 or so years ago. And many of those things were not very fashionable then. Another thing that wasn't so was this park at the center of the mesa. This was a quarry where you would produce the aggregate for roadways and for buildings, sand, gravel, and so on, possibly cement if it's the kind of rock that can make cement. And then instead of leaving this car, as we do in general when we do mining, this car would be made into a man-made park. So with engineers, geologists, technocrats, technologists, you would have architects, artists, craftsmen, and so on, making this into a man-made landscape. There was a center, learning center here connected through this park to a theological center. There were many belts, let's say, of activities. One was for home industries. One was for standard production and marketing. And this was almost a conveyor belt because it was using water, gravity flow, water for transportation, at least half of it. Then there was the villages. There were villages organized around the civic center, so they would have a city, townships organized between those two belts. And finally, at the edge, almost at the edge of the mesa, sunk into the mesa, were recycling plants, where all the rejects, the garbage, the litters, and the sewage would be treated to produce new raw materials, fertilizers, and so on. This was the theological center, this the learning center. This is a suggestion of this landscape, man-made landscape, containing buildings like auditoriums, museums, shrines, public structures, and so on. I try to go quickly through some of those diagrams because they are trying to illustrate my approach to the environmental problems, which is only where you can find an architectural solution to our problems. In this case, I'm showing what, in a way, the universe might be divided in. So I say the nature goes three ways. The deterministic way, which is the universal mass energy. I call this the cosmogenesis. And genesis because we are not dealing with a static thing, but with a process. So you have a cosmogenesis dealing with the mineral universe, let's say. And some of the characteristics of this universe are that it is entropic, statistical, rational, granular, predictable, simulable, and structural. And I call this the world of indifference. It goes by the law of conservation of energy. The genetic way, which is the biological universe, I use the term biogenesis. It's a genesis of the living universe. It is instinctual, unconscious, durational, evolutionary, irreversible, selective, non-simulable, sensitized, social, morphological. It is the universe, the world of innocence. And it somehow it goes by the laws of concentration of energy. Any kind of living phenomenon is a concentration of energy in very peculiar ways with a very complex kind of inner interactions. And then there is the cultural way, which is the human way, and this is the homogenesis. It is mental, conscious, durational, evolutionary, irreversible, willful, non-simulable, compassionate, social, manipulative, formal. So it has many of those characteristics, but you add a few ones, like the cultural, the willful, the compassionate, and so on, and the formal. And this is the world of good and evil, because this is only where good and evil appears. It cannot appear here. This is innocence. Only here you have this choice between the good and the bad. And this, in a way, goes according to the law of incrementation of energy. And by this, I mean the incrementation of the spiritual energy, the mental energy. So you have, in a way, an entropic universe here, and you have an asymptotic universe here. You go from a tendency toward entropy to a tendency toward asymptotic, which means you move from matter into spirit. So you have a spiritualization process, moving from the mineral into the spiritual. I'm going backwards. In this diagram, I'm trying to distinguish between process and becoming. And I'm doing this because we are somehow stuck with this idea of change. And we take change always as something positive, just because of this, for the sake of change. I say that process is manipulation by outer decision. Process belongs to the technological. Growth is manipulation by inner decision. Growth belongs to the biomental. So I'm distinguishing very sharply between the technological and the biomental. And one is an outer, it's something which is decided by an outer force, and the biomental is decided by the inner force. Process is a performance of technology which acts by way of oversimplification. Whenever you introduce technology to solve a problem, you introduce an element of oversimplification. This is how technology can work and succeed in working for us. But growth is a performance of the biomental which acts by way of complexification. So you have a dilemma here, you have a dialectic between using a tool that tends to simplify the problem and the goal, which is not simplification, but complexification. Process defines changes, growth defines engrossment. Contemporary man is mesmerized by change and is starved by lack of engrossment. So this tends to present the problem we are faced with. Technology gives us an oversimplified universe, while the biomental, the spiritual, is seeking a more complex universe. I'll skip the last one. In order to illustrate this question of complexification, I use the seed as an example. The vegetal, the animal, the human, and the social seed originate a cycle of gathering and organizing matter in a progressively complex and responsive organism. When you're watching a seed developing into a plant, for instance, you're not watching an explosive process, you're watching an implosive process. It is the seed, which is some kind of a magnet, able to collect from the environment those things and organize them in such a specific way as to make itself into a small universe. The living is then a cooperative process, not a disintegrative one, which is death. In order to have this process, you have to have utter cooperation. Without cooperation, you don't have plants, animals, societies, life. And it is also an implosive process, not an explosive one. It is a miniaturization process favoring the ever more complex interaction, making the becoming. So this is mandatory wherever you seek life. Wherever you seek non-life, which is death, you have disintegration, explosion, entropy, pollution. Therefore, in any given system, the liveliest quantum is also the most complex. In any given system, the most complex quantum is also the most miniaturized. Now, this is the guideline for my work in going about the problem of the environment. If we want to define, realistically, an environment for man that is evolutionary, we have to fit this methodology, which is the methodology of evolution. I think I'll skip that. It's too long and too small. Now, this complexity and miniaturization process, I try to fit into the archaeological idea. which is this idea of having cities which are a fraction of the size of what they are now, but instead of being flat, they are three-dimensional. And I'm saying that there is a connection between this commitment to many of the problems that we are faced now, the very crucial problem we are faced with. One is the exploding population. So you can serve more people by this archaeological system. You can also take care of the ecological debacle by this archaeological approach. You can take care of the problem of waste. In other words, the solution of the problem of waste is fundamentally in this ability to miniaturize any performance. It takes care automatically, almost because of those two, of the problem of pollution. Pollution is waste. And in a much larger term, pollution is coinciding with entropy. Whatever is against life is pollutant, which means is entropic. You have automatically land, air, and water conservation somehow converging into this commitment. It is a structuring of the environment which disaggregate physically people, institutions, performances, etc. And it is also the only way of really facing the problem of the energy crisis, which is too much consumption for a limited amount of energy available. And this is a very crucial element at this point. And then it has also very much to do with hopefulness, disillusionment, and the ability to see some light in the future. Now, this is all nice talk, but it doesn't mean very much unless you're able to go beyond somehow the means. Those are the means to achieve a certain platform of congruence and health within the biosphere. Unless we go beyond this, we might be a very healthy society, but very dull. So this is in function of the means, of the ends. And the ends are to produce a more lively, more intense, more human life. Now, I've been trying to, in a way, to incorporate those ideas in what is the environment that we could try to develop in order to fit life and the earth. And those are some very sketchy suggestions about this. So from now on, what you see are only suggestions, only symbols, no blueprints. And you should maybe forget most of what you see. Just try to retain the concept and work around it and see if it has merits. This is a sketch, one of the earliest sketches about this idea. And it's, as you see, very, very elementary. But if this is a section of, let's say, of an urban system, you see the ground level here, and everything which is below ground level is given to technology, in the sense that it's automated, is productive, is used for warehousing, and it doesn't need the presence of many people, just checking and fixing and somehow surveying something which works by itself automatically almost. Above ground level, you have the actual city, which means an urban system that has the institutions of the city and the private institution of the person, the family, or the group. The vertical transportation system becomes very essential, and as we all know, it's far more efficient than the horizontal transportation system. Take the elevators and compare it to the car. To illustrate this concept, I worked around 40 schemes and I used 30 in the MIT book, the Archaeology. And some of the schemes were for floating systems, and this is one. Two main types of structures. One is a production center, the other one is an urban center. Very closely organized. And you can begin with one production center, then develop slowly your urban system by having more centers and those ribbons of urban structures enveloping them. This is one of those canisters, production and manipulation of material that you get from the sea, chemicals, minerals, or proteins, storage, shipping, work related to this, and then urban life, and then more urban life on those ribbons. Those are parks. And the whole thing can float. The same idea of a developing community, you start from with a hub and then develops into a metropolitan area. This has to be seen horizontally, not as it is there upright. If you are on a continental shelf and you are anchored to the rock bottom, you can produce energy by having water reservoirs filled and emptied according to the tides, the changing level of the sea. We happen to have a structure which could be, in a way, arcologies if they were planned in a whole different manner. If you have a dam of this nature, which is a block of cement, and you plan it so instead of being a block of cement, it's a porous block of cement. It's carved by design. Instead of having a dead mausoleum, you have a city, which means you can inject into this massive man-made environment the life of a community. By cutting through, this is an elevation, by cutting through there, you have a section. If this is the water body, you have storage, warehousing, and some industries against the water. On your wall, you can have residential facilities, from homes to apartment housing. In a larger structure, you can have the public institutions, from learning to marketing and health and so on. Dams are very special centers, very special points in an ecological system. You have water power, water for different uses, domestic, recreation, irrigation, and so on. You have power, you have roadways, and you have this massive structure. So it's begging for life in a way. This is a smaller scheme, but the same idea of a strong small morphology, which is the dam, which contains different kinds of activities, labs or collections of specimens, and etc., etc. A much larger structure, somehow in the same vein of making this, the dam, into a city. All those appeared into the MIT book. Now, as I said, I had to caution you in seeing in those schemes more than doodles in a way, but they are suggesting dimensions, functions, and relationship. This is close to twice the Empire State Building. And this means it's about 1 mile in diameter. No, the larger diameter, this is about half a mile. And it would be for about 400 or 450,000 people. It's so small as a city that you can walk throughout it in a few minutes, and you can also get out of it within a few minutes. The skin is where you have the private life of the city developing. The inside is where you have the inner, the public, the commercial, the merchandising, and the learning activities. The car is stopped at the edge of the city. It has no way to go into it. There are no roads. So you get the legs again functioning for you. This is a for 1 million population, it's something like a twin city. Again, this dimension is less than 2 miles, I think. You have moving sidewalks, elevators, escalators, bicycles, and legs. Thousands of legs. Millions. If you adopt the idea of the linear city, which sooner or later probably we are adopting it now in a very gross way when we have the Eastern Seaboard becoming a phalanx area of I don't know what. Well, if you adopt that idea, some advantage would be evident. One is that you have a main transportation mode, a linear system which carries all sorts of modes, from trucks to cars, to trains and so on, including airports on the roof. And then you plug in into this main logistical center, which goes throughout the linear city. You plug in your urban communities. So by living in this urban community, you are directly connected with the main transportation system, with the urban institutions, and also with the open landscape. This is so because you contain the transversal dimension within maybe 3 miles or so. Given this idea, you had to bridge obstacles. So this is a suggestion of bridging a river or bridging a canyon. So this bridge becomes a town of, I don't know if it was 30 or 70,000 people, and something similar here. I had extremes illustrated in the book to suggest the possibilities, the almost endless variety that you can obtain once you accept the three-dimensional approach. This is a little town of about 3,000 people compared to the Empire State Building. This is a larger one, about 170,000. This is about 250,000. This is 450,000. This is still the Empire State Building. Now, I have to tell you again that there is no reason to go to those extremes. You can stay within those limits and come up with a very substantial town or city. This is the little one, about 30,000, showing the inside. And this would be where the public life would be somehow served. Shopping, learning, playing, promenading, and so on. And the outer, this is where the very private life could be. This is a larger one, about 270,000, and it's really a cluster of skyscrapers. But instead of being isolated needles sticking out from one floor of logistics, or two or three, it's a connection of those skyscrapers at many levels, on a radius, radially, and on the circumference, and so on, horizontally and non-horizontally, so that you have a good flow, a good logistical flow, which is absolutely mandatory wherever you are dealing with not thousands or millions, but billions of interactions. This is the smaller one. This is the tail of that one. One of the somehow midway terraces with gardens and so on, which is here. In this one, we try to suggest the variety you can achieve once the skeletal system, which I call the three-dimensional topography, is established. And the three-dimensional topography is the carrier of the main logistics. This is the same one. This has been used by Playboy in the June issue. And they landscaped it quite well, but they made it so enormous that it's taller than a mountain. You'll see it when it comes out. It's too bad it is out of proportion because the montage is pretty good. It's a section of that one. Still the same one. Now this is the scariest one. It's a cube of 1 kilometer inside, about 450,000 people. And it's, in a way, was the challenge of accepting a given shape, the cube, and trying to organize it into an urban system. So there are skyscrapers supporting this cube put on edge, landing facilities, and the skin is the residential, which doesn't have to be only apartment housing, can be all sorts of things, including mansions. Some of the inside view. Well, one of the 30 examples in the book is this space capsule for about 70,000 people. And instead of being only a gadget deprived of any biological references beside our people living there, it is a cylinder, you see half of it, which is lined by vegetation, part of the metabolic say, system. And it works because you have a rotation on this axis, which produces a gravity. So you stand inside of this landscape instead of being on top of it like we are on the Earth. And because of this is a pressurized system, the whole structure is a tensile structure. And those are the equivalent of skyscrapers, let's say. And you can float out of your window and navigate within this landscape that surrounds you. So you have trees, you have the green stuff on the ceiling, which is about 100 feet away or something like that. Anyhow, you are living, as I was saying, inside of this green landscape. There are other elements that are very much useful for the idea of what the city can be while you work on this subject. An environment which is fitted within our non-environment, the non-environmental space. Oh boy. I'm pushing the wrong button. Excuse me. I'm getting there. This was the subject of some work with a former company and the Rutgers University. And this is a plan for an airport near New York, between New York and Newark, in the meadows. Those are the landing strips, and those are taxiing roads going into this taxiing rig. So you land practically in the center of the city without ever flying on top of it. And you land in here, you are taxied there, so you go into the city or you come from the city. The city is 800 feet high, 2.5 kilometers in diameter, about 1 million population. The skin again is the private, the inside is the public. Those are industries, indicated in purple, covered over by gardens and parks, which is indicated here. So the hub is within a green belt. This is the model, you have the cities as all green. This is the taxing going all around. Some gardens in the structure itself. The anchor tower. And finally, the work we are doing now in Adarkozanti. Now, we had some schemes for this, some diagrams for this 3D Jersey structure showing in minutes and feet distances and time gaps between performances. That indicates that you can somehow make your day longer because you become more effective in your activities by cutting off all the gaps between events or performances. We had executives, housewives, repairmen, and so on. Now, this is the work we do at Cordes Junction. We began with an idea that was discarded because it was too flat, not three-dimensional enough. I took a little section of this idea, which is that, and I developed it in a much larger, but much more pulled together structure. This is the land we are buying for 860 acres. We are using only 1% of that land for the building. So the encroachment on the land is going to be minimal. This is the actual site, some of the farmland we have. And this is the rough model of the building we are working at. We are building now some facilities here, here, and here. Last year, we spent most of the time in setting up the camp. The camp is disassemblable. Those are all panels you can take apart. For instance, this is the shower and the toilet area. And keep pushing the wrong button. And it was made, the design was such that it would suggest a very frugal approach to life, almost like a cell, let's say a monastic approach in a way. And the camp is going to become later on maybe a playground or a camping ground for people who want to be there only one or two days, one or two nights. We have a larger building which is this octagon, which has the same area of one of the towers in the building. We are working at defining textures and colors that are very much in the nature of the landscape, let's say. This is the site where we are building. This is the camp, organic garden, using the garbage as a compost. Those cubes are 8.5 feet inside, those are 12 feet inside. I don't know what's happening here. This is the side of the building. The building would be about this high. It's about 25 stories at the highest, and it's about 10 acres. This is part of the beginning of the building. This is a studio I'm putting up for myself. And this floor area is the same as the floor area of one of those columns. This is a girl that's been there 2 years now. She's operating the crane. Some of the insides of the model. The view of the camp from my studio, it's finished. In this view of the model, one of the apses, I'm showing the possibility that you have of planning your own environment. If you live there, you can define the inside and you can define part of the outside by spilling out from, let's say, from your window. So that at the end you would have some kind of a discipline given by the main structure and then this freedom of expression in the detail, which is what I'm suggesting for all the ecologies. In this plan, which is a very very schematic plan of the building, you see the use of those apses in all the orientations. You define environments which are enclosed but sheltered, and they have different climates, different lights, and so on. The same structure are supporting many buildings inside, because they're very powerful shapes. You can see them there. You can see the scale there of a person. This is 160 feet in diameter. Yeah.
Would you like to excuse the people who have another class, or would you like to them just to leave quietly one by one?
I'm almost through with the slides.
One
minute more.
Okay.
Those are spaces, the smallest units, the modules in the whole building. There are five module systems. This is the smallest in the apsis. I will show you the buildings before you leave, so I'll go fast. We are building those. This is the batching plan. We are building office and living quarters. We are building an apse, which is the ceramics work area. We are building an oven for metal work. We are building the equivalent of a restaurant. This is the foundation here. This is going to be a crane, a horizontal crane. That's why this is so substantial. And those are the two foundations. We cast the arches and the panels. We are assembling them now. This is last spring, last summer. This is the vault going up. The casting of the vault in panels, 12 panels to be assembled, that which is we are doing now, which is what we are doing now. This is linoleum, and we are painting the silt and the linoleum to get somehow a ceiling which is pluricromatic. This is the beginning of the assembling of those arches that are going to support the crane, and then the panels are going to be in between. Blasting. This is an apse where we are doing the ceramics. We're going to do the ceramics work. This is in the center of a larger apse. This is only a 40 feet and is inside of a 160 feet apse. The same center. It's facing south, so it has this ability of collecting the winter sun and shading the summer sun. That's it. This is another step in this apse. This is where the vault is going to be. Now, I have some information, if anyone's interested. We are registering, we are taking students.